At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, Reese Shearsmith, star and writer of League of Gentlemen and Inside Number 9, on his new movie, In the Earth. Phil Lynott, Songs for While I'm Away, hits cinemas this weekend, and I chat to its director, Emma Reynolds, about bringing Philo to the big screen. Mark Ryle reviews this week's new releases, which include Anthony Hopkins' incredible performance in The Father, plus hurling legend and Renaissance man Tony Griffin on his favourite movie. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. right here on Newstalk. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me, screentime@newstalk.com. Good weekend to you all. I got the jab on Thursday. Hooray, the elation for something that, you know, didn't exist 16 months ago. The joy of coming out of that vaccine center, having got my first dose, was incredible. Even getting the text, it's like the chosen. Anyway, we're all going to be chosen, and half of us have been already, and your time will come, and it's a nice feeling, it really is. Now, I have a very busy show this week, so I'm going to have to dispense with my normal, you should watch this on TV, because there's just too much happening. Chief among all that's happening is this.
We had to send a rescue party in to get a group out a couple of months ago. They got lost.
Why didn't they use GPRS?
There's no phone reception in there. People get a bit funny in the woods sometimes.
You worried she's gonna get you?
Yeah, who is it?
It's a local folk tale. She's the spirit of the woods.
You tell me his story. These are his memories. Can you feel him now? In the earth.
No, I don't know what you mean.
I think you do.
Yes, now that was a clip from In the Earth, which will be in Irish cinemas from next Thursday. And it's from acclaimed director Ben Wheatley, who gave us things like Sightseers, High Rise, The Kill List, and last year's version of Rebecca, which is still on Netflix, which I interviewed him about, actually. And he's a kind of horror slash comedic, all sorts of kind of styles. A very unique movie maker. And in this movie, it takes place, strangely, when the world is in the grip of a virus. It's an unnamed virus, which is quite odd. And a scientist played by Joel Fry and a park ranger, they kind of venture into this forest where this scientist is trying to find another scientist about 15 miles in this forest in a medical facility where they're trying to, you know, find some cures from this forest to help with this virus. But this forest is a very strange place and it's inhabited by weird forces. Chief among them is a man called Zach, who appears to be this guy who's just decided to live in a forest and is living off the grid. But there may be a bit more to Zach than that. And Zach is played by Reese Shearsmith, who people know as the writer and star, one of the writers and stars of things like The League of Gentlemen, that great English TV show, Psychoville, and lately Inside Number 9, which people love. Different every week, all about the number 9 features in it in some way, like on a door, or but it has these different anthology stories each week with different actors. Really good show. Anyway, I spoke to Reese about In the Earth, League of Gentlemen, and all sorts of other things. Take a listen to this. I spoke to Ben for Rebecca, which he did last year. And I actually said to him during the interview, you are so unpretentious for a director, because he knows his movies inside out, but he's bullshit free, you know? And I'm wondering, this is his third movie I think you've done with him. What's a Ben Wheatley set like? Is it a pretentious free working environment?
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah. Ben is very sort of happy to have any suggestion thrown at him. He will not, is in no way megalomaniacal about how it's this way, my way or the highway. You know, he's very collaborative and I get on with him very well because I think we've got a sort of shared interest in horror and comedy as well. And it's a thrill to work with him. We're always pushing each other to try and get the right moment or the way of doing something. And he doesn't give lots of notes about character. He's quite oblique in the way that he'll give you snippets, but never the full picture. Yeah. And I think he likes that. That then he's left. There's an air of mystery about you filling in the gaps as the audience.
Yeah.
And so that's an interesting way of working. But he's fantastic. His sets are. I mean, it was an extraordinary experience doing In the Earth because of all pandemic and COVID, and that was a strange experience. And we were out. I think one of the few, if the only people doing it at that time in August.
Yeah.
So it was great. We're all PPE'd up, but always a thrill to work with him. And he told me about the film in April, and then we were doing it in August. Amazing.
So there's a couple of movies made in lockdown, and you know they tend to happen very fast because of all the stuff that was going on in the world. Was this a fast shoot in that way then? You showed up at a forest and cracked on through it.
Yeah, it was pretty much, yeah. But I mean, I think regardless of COVID, it might have been the same length. We did that. Field in England in 14 days.
Okay.
I think he just knows, he calibrates very well what is required. You know, he knows he's not making Spider-Man.
Yeah. So now, so, that'd be interesting. Not that In the Earth isn't interesting.
But. Yes, yeah. But yeah, it was very quick, very speedy, and very enjoyable.
Your character, Zach, is funny. When he sure showed up, I was like, oh, that's Reese, because you looked a bit like Robert Plant. And I mean that as a compliment, as a big Led Zeppelin fan. The character, like, I don't want to give any spoilers, but did it really appeal to you when you read him? Because at first he's this dude living off the grid with long hair, and then it takes a very Ben Wheatley, almost League of Gentlemen turn.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was a great thrill to read it for the first time and see the trajectory of that character and where he starts and where he ends up. It was a great thrill to think I was going to be able to play that. I remember saying to Ben at one point when I'm later in the film, when things have gone a bit wrong, thank you so much for writing this part for me. And I was really genuinely having a time of my life, I think. So it was great to play the extremes of characters, you know. And Zach, for a long time, I keep a lid on it. And I think one of the creepier parts about him is that he's very certain and sure and calm about what his belief is. And, you know, all hell breaks loose as we go down the road.
Yeah. People know you because of your love of horror as well as other things. And there was a lot of times in this, I was thinking, and I don't mean it as a criticism or anything, but, you know, ancestors of this movie from everything, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, like you'd never run out of a list of horror movies. Did you feel some of those when you were making it? This reminds me of this.
Oh, yes, very definitely. Yeah. I mean, and it's sort of part of the game of the film, I think, that it feels like you go through different genres of film in the journey of this film. It's weirdly starts like a strange buddy movie, and then we go a weird Texas Chainsaw slasher in the woods type scenario, and then we end up in Quatermass in this science. And so that was all part of, I think, the tussle of the argument, if you like, that Ben wanted to explore with this, which is human man and human beings need to make stories to have meaning, you know, the narratives we tell each other and ourselves get us through day by day in extreme circumstances. And Zach's got a version of that that clarifies in his mind why he's ended up the way he's ended up and what he's worshipping. And Dr. Wendell, as the science version, has the same belief, different trajectory, but they're equally mad, both of them. They're just stories. They're mad storytelling devices that allow a way through.
Yeah.
I think that's the exploration of the film, really.
Yeah. Can I just ask you briefly about Inside Number 9, which is continuing to have a very long life. And for people who don't know, it's an intriguing show where the number 9 plays a small and sometimes important role, and you've all these different stories. Is the popularity of that, I was thinking, almost something against the era of streaming and where you have to, you know, with some shows almost give over your entire life to them. I adore Game of Thrones, but I was saying to someone when I watched the first episode, I was a single guy. By the finale came around, I was married with three children. Yes. Whereas Inside Number 9, not to do it a disservice, but you can watch one and that's it. There's something to be said for that TV in the era that we live in, I guess.
Absolutely, yeah. I think it's the resurgence of the anthology series and format is not a coincidence that I think it's happened in the wake of all these, the commitment that you're expected to give to huge box sets that last for decades. You know, how many years of your life have you got left?
Yeah.
Number 9 and one-off stories, a very appealing thing to just have a good, it's like being told a great little joke, you know, beginning, middle, end, get out, watch them in any order, no commitment. And I think that is a side of humans now that we like, you know, everything is in short, tiny bites down to
TikTok.
You get sent something on a YouTube clip that's a minute, 1 minute 30, and you're like, I haven't got time for this. So, you know, people like things in shorter bursts.
Yeah. And do you, like, you know, you run out of all the actors you've had in it, but like Timothy West, Ireland's own Fiona Shaw, do you every season come up with a kind of, I wonder if we can get these people?
Yeah, toward the end of when we've written them, we don't ever write them with anyone in mind because you're never sure you could get them, and then you'd be heartbroken if you
never
that person. So toward when it gets to the point of casting and you've got 3 weeks before you're doing it, then the net is cast and you get who would be good for this part or be interesting in this part, and you get availabilities, and if they're free, then you put a checklist of number one at the top, and then if they say no, you move down to the next one. I mean, we've never really had anyone say no, and everyone is thrilled to be asked. So that's because they're a very appealing time frame for these.
Yeah.
Filmed in a week. You know, it's very easy to be just slot it in if you're an actor.
Yeah.
So I think
I never thought of that.
We just, they're like, oh, 6 days. Yes, I can do that.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I presume you pay them something as well. So.
And there's like, yeah, they get their travel card.
Listen, finally, and you know, I'm sure you haven't done an interview where this hasn't come up, but for men in their 30s and 40s, you know, your face was probably on some of the bedroom walls with your other pals in League of Gentlemen. It's, you know, it was just remarkable TV. They call it a cult, but I think it was probably too popular to be a cult. But I'm just wondering, looking back now all these years, and particularly at the TV shows that, you know, changed so much of TV, and clearly I'm a fanboy of it, but looking back now, can you remember what you were sitting down to do, or were you just actually, you know, pals trying to make a TV show, or did you have I'm sure you didn't have a vision or a grand, but it was such a revolutionary kind of TV show. I'm wondering at Source, what were you guys with Steve and Mark, what were you actually thinking of doing when you sat down to write it and make it all those years ago?
Well, I think it genuinely was making something that we found funny. It was sort of born of being actors writing comedy and wanting to tell sort of longer stories with... like on, you know, all began on stage, and we just wanted to tell, to have some really good tight sketches. A lot of it was the need to make it polished as a live show, and the characters came from awkward situations, people we'd known, a funny jumping off point of a man trying to tell a joke and never not letting it go. And so, but because we're all actors, we really wanted to breathe real life into these characters. Sketch initially, you know, you think of a sketch as something very quickly drawn, but we wanted to really have you care about these people. And when it came to do the TV, we were suddenly fleshing out the, what do these people look like? We've only ever done it on stage with very cool costume. And we never had a master plan. We just did it because we couldn't not do it on the footage. And we took it to the Edinburgh Festival, and there people that didn't know us laughed at it. And that was the most thrilling time, because it was like, it actually works. It's not just our friends being kind.
Yeah. Well, listen, we cared a lot, me most of all. Thanks very much for talking to me, Reese. Cheers.
Brilliant. Thanks, John. See you.
Yes, Reese Shearsmith there talking to me about Inside Number 9, The League of Gentlemen, and his new movie, In the Earth, which is in cinemas and directed by Ben Wheatley, next Thursday, the 17th of June, here in Ireland. I'm still quite ebullient about, you know, saying in cinemas, because I haven't said that for a long time. And there is a lot in cinemas. And after the break, we'll be talking about a great movie that's coming to cinemas this weekend as of this Friday. And that's Phil Lynott, Songs for While I'm Away.
Screen Time on News Talk.
Now you're listening to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. Phil Lynott, Songs for While I'm Away, is a fantastic new documentary. Well, all about Phil Lynott, obviously, that gets a cinema release finally this Friday. That's the 11th of June. It tells, I suppose, the previously reasonably well-known story of the boy from Crumlin who became, well, a rock icon before we even knew what rock icons were in Ireland. But it does this story in a very different and unique way. It's directed by Emma Reynolds, and I'm delighted to say she joins me now. Hi, Emma.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me on.
So listen, I said at the start there, you know, it's a well-known story. It certainly is to me, but I'm a big fan. And that's not to do it a disservice, because I was saying to you before we came on, you know, does the world need another documentary about Phil Lynott? And I watched your movie, and it certainly does, based on this documentary, because it's wonderful from start to finish. But what was your motivation for doing it? People might know the last thing you directed was a documentary about the Voyager program, all about this wonderful object out in space. So why did you want to make a documentary about Phil Lynott?
I was a huge Thin Lizzy and Phil Lynott fan from when I was a teenager. And Alan Marr, one of this film's producers, approached me having seen The Farthest and hearing I was a Thin Lizzy fan, basically approached me to see what I'd be interested in coming on board. They were looking at developing this feature about Phil Lynott, and I nearly bit his arm off, because it was a dream come true for me, you know, to get a chance to learn more about the man behind the rock star. You know, I like all fans. I probably just saw him as this incredibly iconic, confident, you know, incredible performer with the huge legs and the hair and the twinkle, and not really knowing an awful lot about his Phil, the private man, you know, the man behind the mask. So a massive opportunity for me and my team to really get to know him, you know, and get to know maybe the story behind what you might see as the image.
One, there's a couple of things that work really well, but one of them is the music sounds like I was hearing it for the first time, even though, like a lot of people, a lot of these songs are the soundtrack to my life. Did you do something different with the music? Because it sounds so fresh.
Yeah, no, we didn't do anything different. Obviously, some of it has been remastered over the years, you know, and it has been given a lot of love over the years. We had a wonderful sound mixer, Brendan Rehill, who did an incredible job. And some of the desire at certain parts in the film was definitely, you know, to have our audience feel, if they could, if they see it in the cinema, hopefully they would get the experience, you know, to feel almost like they were at a Thin Lizzy gig, you know, to generate that frisson, that visceral excitement you get while standing there. Yeah. So we worked very hard to, you know, to really give the song center stage, because the film is predicated, you know, utterly on the idea of Philip's life through his songs, you know.
Yeah.
That really allowing the stories, in the absence of having the ability, sadly, to interview the great man himself, you know, the thesis was to allow the songs to talk for him, you know, that this was a direct line into his heart, into his thinking, into his experiences, you know, and to allow the songs take center stage in that way.
Yeah, and I would second what you're saying in terms of seeing it in the cinema, because you want to hear this music with that big Dolby surround sound. Another thing that's really impressive about it is I'm sure people like Huey Lewis, Midge, and possibly even James Hetfield are asked to talk about Phil Lynott all the time and respectfully or not respectfully decline. Was it hard to get those heavyweights? Adam Clayton's there as well.
No, it wasn't hard to get them once they, you know, clued into the sort of film we were trying to make. You know, I think my team, a wonderful team of researchers, reached out to them and expressed that, you know, the tone of the film from the start was coming from a place of love and compassion and tenderness rather than salacious interest in, you know, the flaming star that burned too bright and went out, that cliche of of a rock icon falling sadly the way Philip did. So really talking to them at heart, you know, about what we wanted to do in terms of Phil the man and to tell the story in a tender and poetic and compassionate way. And all of them have a connection to him, as opposed to just being you know, voices from the music industry who will comment on him. You know, they were all friends of his. They all knew him. Some of them worked with him. So they were definitely coming from a place of intimacy and friendship and wanted to be on this journey with us.
Midge, or when he shows up on the American tour on stage, I don't know how you got that material, but he looks like a 17-year-old who was reading smash hits on the plane. It's just delightful to see him on stage.
That clip of him playing Waiting for an Alibi literally makes me laugh every single time I see it, because he's straight out of that 80s moment with the big shoulders and the hair, and completely out of sync with the look of Thin Lizzy. So I think it's wonderful. And he definitely does look like a child on Christmas. He's so excited.
Yeah. You know, it was funny. You kind of put your finger on it there. You made something clear to me that I guess I was thinking on some level, and that it isn't, you know, a story you're trying to tell, this star who burns too bright. And I was thinking, you don't labor the tragedy. I mean, obviously it's there, but I don't think the word heroine is even mentioned. Now, here am I bringing it up, so forgive me, but I just mean that was clearly part of your raison d'etre, that it wasn't going to be, you know, the, not that he was in the 27 Club, but another rags to, you know, star shine too bright story. That was your raison d'etre from the beginning, obviously.
Yeah, Scott, who was also in the grip of that addiction at the same time, he mentions Class A drugs, and he mentions, you know, that at the point in their history when drugs started to become, you know, more dangerous, more of a darker side, rather than just, you know, the recreational thing they were talking about they were doing in the early days. So we do obviously deal with that part of his life, that sad addiction and that sad ending, dying so young with small children. You know, it's a tragic story, but I'm just of the view that his life and his creativity and his work is more interesting than his death. And really, you know, I wanted to treat his sad addiction and death with the compassion I would for anybody, you know, but for the grace of God go I, kind of a feeling, you know, that it's not here to entertain us. It's a sad part of his life and must be marked, but it's not what the film is about. The film is about, as I say, his life, his poetry, his dreams, you know, his character. He was so fun. He had such an adventure, and really to have come from such a working class part of Dublin in the 50s and to scale such incredible heights, to be on the stage at the Sydney Opera House in front of 100,000 screaming fans, you know, it's an incredible story, and his music is incredible.
Absolutely. No argument for me. And it's funny, there's a bit where Scott actually says, I guess we're going to get to the drugs now, which I thought was quite pointed. But that's another thing about the movie. Phil's sheer delight at times, like when he's on stage opposite the Opera House in Sydney, I think there were shots of him. It looked like Newcastle at times. I was mixing up my bridges. But when he's on these massive stages, he was elated. Like he had that thing that this was where he belonged, and he was probably at his happiest, like Bruce Springsteen or Elvis or any of those people. Like he had that joy.
Yeah, Jim Fitzpatrick talks about him in the film that Philip was born to be a rock star, you know, and I think Caroline, his wife, said to me at one stage that he was a rock star while he was brushing his teeth. You know, he just had that charisma. He had that incredible, you know, excitement. And yet the film, you know, I think is also a wonderful part of the story. We learned that he was a pretty shy man, a pretty private man, and he almost created this rock star persona, you know, as a vehicle, as armor, as Adam Clayton says in the film, in order to be able to get through that, you know. So he wasn't a natural, you know, he was like us all. He was all sides of a coin, you know. He wasn't just incredibly charismatic and confident, you know. He was also shy and insecure, and, you know, and that makes him human like us all, and his story resonates at that because of that.
It certainly does. Another thing that comes out in the movie, with again great clips and footage, you found that he was always very keen to assert his Irishness, whether it was in the UK or America or wherever he was being interviewed, that this was part of what he was selling. That was front and center. That came across in your film anyway.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's a gorgeous part of his, I think it's a gorgeous part of why we in Ireland love him. He kept his accent, you know, he didn't dilute it. It doesn't become kind of mid-Atlantic. You know, he's got a proper, big, full-on Dublin accent all the way through his life, kept a home in Howth, made his wife come home to have the children in Holles Street, you know, which is such a classic Irish emigrant experience, you know, that you want your children to be Irish. So he's very proud of Ireland, very proud of his Irish heritage, and yet was born in England, you know, and moved here at age 7. So it's a very modern story. It's a very modern story for the 50s and 60s of of how Irish people are, you know. And
yeah,
and Ireland is part of his singing as well, you know, his songwriting. He's writing about Irish myths and legends, Irish poetry, you know. So it's great to see his pride in it. And I love that. I love a lot of those songs. I love seeing that you know, that idea of the man comes out of his childhood and out of his education and out of his experience. He had a very happy childhood in Crumlin. So, you know, it's lovely to see him staying as a proud Irishman his whole life.
Yeah. One of the other things that I hadn't realized was their whole American odyssey. And I suppose, like, even though you've great footage of gigs in America that seem to be going swimmingly, they never quite broke America to the extent that, you know, what we say when we mean breaking America, like the way a U2 did or the Cranberries or whatever. How much of a source of regret was that for him, do you think?
I'm not wanting to speak for him. I think profound regret. I think profound regret for them all that it never really, you know, absolutely broke through. They had a good degree of success. And even in the States now, you'll find certain cities on the coasts, you know, you'll find certain cities where they're huge and remembered. But never, The Boys Are Back in Town was a big breakout hit and a number of other songs that made it through, but they never really achieved the success. As you say, maybe he might have been dreaming of success like Queen or, you know, something huge like that. But I think a great source of regret to him. But he says in the film, and I think this is also who he was, he put a positive spin on it. He said, yeah, maybe we didn't have luck on our side in America. And they certainly didn't. Three tours in a row kind of fell down for various reasons.
Yeah.
But he said, we didn't have luck on our side. But overall, and he's right, worldwide, in Europe, in Asia, in Australia, they were massive. You know, they were a very lucky and very loved band. So I think I find that in his interviews, that he will, he'll be honest to express the regret and then also put a positive spin on it. And that's who he was.
Yeah. Well, the film is absolutely delightful for Lizzie fans, Philo fans, and for just music fans in general and fans of an Irish icon. Now, I mentioned, I think you should see it in the cinema. You've had this a while, so you must be delighted that it's finally getting a big screen release on Friday the 11th of June.
I know. We're this is our third or fourth time. We were supposed to release last summer, then last October, then we were supposed to release on Stephen's Day, but the pandemic shut down cinemas just before Christmas. So it's a third, fourth time lucky. And, you know, I can't wait to get it into the cinemas for Irish audiences to see it up on the big screen where really it's designed to be seen. It's loud, it's colorful, it's sexy. The music is ringing out in your ears, you know, and it's a proper cinema experience. So really excited that it's finally going to be up on the big screen and putting Phil center stage back where he belongs.
Well, so say all of us. Phil Lynott, Songs for While I'm Away, will be in cinemas, the place where you should see it, on Friday the 11th of June. Its director, Emer Reynolds, was talking to me. Emer, thank you very much and good luck with it.
Thank you so much.
One Monday morning, we called down to the headmaster and he goes, what do you want to do? Do you want a good, steady trade, a job, or do you want to be a dirty rock musician?
The soft, silky tones of Phil Lynott there. Just a little snatch of audio as heard from the wonderful Phil Lynott. Songs for While I'm Away, directed by Emer Reynolds. And it is a glorious tribute to the man. He had that great speaking voice as well. It's funny, his wife, Caroline, in the movie says, you know, he had this gorgeous voice. It sounded like he was in bed whenever he was talking to you. And she said, a lot of the time he was. A great movie. Yes, now we turn to some other new releases this week, which include finally arriving in Ireland in cinemas, The Father, which Anthony Hopkins won an Oscar for. We're also looking at the new Bob Odenkirk movie, Nobody, and Angelina Jolie in Those Who Wish Me Dead. I'm joined now by my regular partner in crime, Mark Royal. Mark, how are you?
I'm good, John. How are you doing?
I'm great. I was saying earlier in the show, I got my first jab and you have two now. So, you know, finally we have something in common.
I'm only 25. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yes, indeed.
I just look older.
It was a clerical error. Well, listen, The Father is the big new release of the week, which is in cinemas from this Friday. Just tell our listeners what's happening in The Father.
Yeah, you wait all year for an Anthony Hopkins movie and then two arrive at once. This is the first movie directed by the playwright Florian Zeller, and it's based on his own play. And it's a profoundly affecting, and at times it can be absolutely devastating piece of work. Mm. And I think there are moments in this that will stay with you for a very long time. There's certainly moments that stayed with me. Anthony Hopkins plays a character called Anthony, who is an 80-year-old with progressive dementia. And Olivia Colman is Anthony's daughter, Anne. And Anne has tried everything she can think of to improve both her father's situation and her own, and nothing has worked, obviously. And during moments of lucidity, Anthony remains resolutely determined to keep his independence and to stay at home in his own flat. And as the film begins, he has just fallen out with another healthcare assistant, and his daughter is at the end of her rope.
Yes. What I don't want to jump ahead, but what I thought was brilliant about it, and which is a big part of the movie, is that it shows I said this earlier in the week, the phenomenology, as in the conscious state of a person with dementia, because you see a lot of the movie through Anthony Hopkins and him mixing up different people and the sheer frustration of him not knowing what's going on at times, and then at other times when he's lucid, comparing that reality to his unlucid state, is just, it was spellbinding and tragic. Yeah. And wonderful cinema in equal measure.
It is like a conversation from 5 years ago might have just happened. Obviously dementia is the cruelest of fates. Condition that you know, it lays waste to everything in its path. And if I'd say most of us will have known someone with the condition and will be aware of the consequences, and if you don't, then you should count yourself very lucky. But what the father does, and it does very, very well, is to put you inside the head of a person suffering from dementia, whether you want to be there or not. And there are constants that Anthony, that's the character now, every time I'm talking about Anthony, you can presume I'm talking about the character in the movie. And there are constants that he clings to and he goes back to over and over again, like his watch that he's convinced people are trying to steal from him, and his favorite daughter, who is not Olivia Colman, that she is going to come and visit him soon. But these constants keep on slipping from him. And there are elements of horror here in the, I suppose, the corridors and the shifting surroundings, and a door that led to a hospital room in a previous scene now leads into a cupboard, and the furniture in the room is subtly changed, so you're never quite sure where you are, and time is warped, and the narrative is non-linear, I suppose, and that extends as well to the faces around Anthony as well.
Yeah.
As we said, Olivia Colman plays the daughter, but then in other scenes it's played by Olivia Williams. And her husband is in the main played by Rufus Sewell, but then in other scenes it's Mark Gatiss. So it puts you in the head of the person with dementia.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny you said horror there, because I hadn't thought of that, and it's certainly not a horror, but I guess the way the rooms change.
No, it's not, but there's elements of it.
Yeah, and of course, you know, dementia is a horror in lots of ways. So maybe that point is well made. The other thing. Another point I want to make, well made or not, is also that Olivia Colman is brilliant in it as the daughter who's torn between, you know, stoic, almost British, let's keep going, and utter heartbreak at the demise of her father, and her own resolve and sometimes lack of resolve to try and eke out her own life outside of her father. Like, she is brilliant in it. I know Anthony Hopkins is rightly getting lots of plaudits, but Olivia Colman is fantastic as well.
She is. I would cast Olivia Colman in everything. I don't think there's anything that she can't do. But this character Anne, it's definitely her stock in trade. You know, putting on a brave face while she's being mercilessly attacked, and trying to smile while, you know, she's getting it in the neck. That's what she does really, really well.
Yeah. Now.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say we could talk about this movie for hours, really, because there's so much going on in it, but we'll round out soon because we've other movies to get to. But I said Anthony Hopkins getting all the plaudits, and we can't forget Olivia Colman, but just to take the truck back, Anthony Hopkins is sensational in it, and you know, up until I'd seen this, it was the only Oscar contender for all the movies that I hadn't seen. And I kind of thought, why haven't they given it to Chadwick Boseman and, you know, Anthony Hopkins playing an aging person? It just seems too obvious. Let's give it to Anthony Hopkins. And then I saw it. And yeah. Not that the Oscars really mean anything, but if you had to take a pick, I do think it was the best performance by a male in a leading role, having watched it. He's brilliant.
He is. It's well deserved. I think a late career highlight anyway. Mm. I think the line that really hit me was, I think he says something like, I feel as though I'm losing all of my leaves.
Yeah.
And it's just heartbreaking. But he goes from, you know, paranoia and aggression to fear. And then ultimately what you're left with is it's an 80-year-old man who's crying for his mummy. And it really is heartbreaking.
Yeah. It's so sad, but in a way, you know, it's like saying water is wet, you know, it's a sad, sad movie, but it is brilliantly executed. It really is. What would you say stars wise?
I'm going to give it a 4.
Yeah, I'm with you as well. I'm going to give it a 4. It's deeply affecting movie. Let's take a quick clip.
Oh, I was a dancer.
Were you?
Yes.
Dad?
What?
You were an engineer.
What do you know about it? Yes, tap dancing was my specialty.
Really?
You seem surprised.
Yeah, a little bit.
Why, don't you believe me? Or you find that difficult to imagine?
Of course, it's just I've always loved tap dancing.
You really? Wow, I'm still great at it. I'll show you. Aye! Jolly good. Why are you laughing?
Sorry.
I know who she reminds me of.
Who?
It's Lucy. Lucy when she was younger.
Lucy?
Yeah, my other daughter. That's right. There's a resemblance, don't you think?
Yeah, maybe.
Yes. Yes. Her unbearable habit of laughing inanely. I had you there, didn't I?
A clip there from The Father, starring Anthony Hopkins and Olivia Colman. Mark and I gave it 4. It is in the cinema from this Friday, and I would suggest you go and see it because it is an immense piece of movie making. Now, something very different, Mark, is Bob Odenkirk in Nobody.
Indeed, yeah. In a nutshell, this is Bob Odenkirk doing a normcore John Wick. Odenkirk plays a vigilante in chinos and a polo shirt called Hutch Mansell. Hutch is an accountant. He's working for his father-in-law. He commutes on the bus. He forgets to put the bins out. And
he puts them out too late and chases the bin truck down the road.
Exactly.
We've all been there.
Well, he's such a non-entity that his wife and kids practically walk through him. Mm. But Hutch used to be a state-sanctioned assassin, and then he made the decision to retire and to live as normal a life as possible. And then a middle of the night home invasion and his daughter's stolen kitty cat bracelet sets in motion a chain of events that puts Odenkirk at odds with the Russian mafia.
Yes. And then ensues something along the lines of a kind of humorous Taken or John Wick kind of thing with Bob Odenkirk as a kind of unlikely but charming vigilante badass.
It is he's very unlikely. I mean, he wouldn't be the first actor you'd think of for a part like this. It has a great cold open with Odenkirk sitting in a police interview with a packet of cigarettes, a tin of tuna, a kitten, and the original Van Gogh's Bedroom at Arles.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the work is done in the first 15 minutes. The setup is so intriguing and well handled that I was already invested in this story.
Yeah.
And therefore, I was more likely to forgive some of the movie's less impressive elements later on. So I was already sold on this by the time that I realized that the final act gets a bit Death Wish meets Home Alone,
or
that it suffers slightly from crap villain syndrome, if I can make something like that up.
Yeah, did you not think, though, that crap villains were meant to be kind of comic book and humorous, maybe?
Possibly. I mean, it's very tongue-in-cheek, the whole thing. I just thought that the Russian bad guy, I think he was played by, is it Alexei Serbyakov? Yeah, I just found him a bit one-dimensional.
Mm. Yeah.
The thing about this is that it's very derivative and it's not particularly original. The script is by Derek Kolstad, who has written all 3 John Wick movies. So he's nothing if not consistent.
A
lot of it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But I think if you're willing to park your sense of disbelief, and I was, then it is a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think I completely agree with you. I think it's daft, but entertaining. And the opening 15 minutes have you hook, line and sinker. And my wife, who watched it with me, knew nothing about it and just sat down. And she had the same kind of, like, at about 15 minutes in, she was like, oh, I like this, you know?
Yeah.
And then at the end, kind of felt the same way. Yeah, I mean, she's used to daft company all the time, obviously, but had the same feeling of, you know, that was a bit bizarre, but it was fun. We watched the whole way through. So yeah. I think we're in agreement on that one. What would you say stars wise?
I'm going to give it 3.5. It worked for me, you know.
Wow. I'm going to give it 3.5 as well. Yeah. It also worked for me. great. Now, listen, the last movie is Angelina Jolie. This hasn't happened in a while, but I actually, this is a sign of the cinemas reopening, but I actually haven't got to see this. So those who wish me dead, tell us quickly what's going on here. I don't think you want to spend too long on it anyway. So.
It certainly doesn't deserve it. It's about a forensic accountant and his son on the run from unspecified malevolent conspiracy forces. But what I really want to talk about is Angelina Jolie. She plays a character called Hannah, and she's a renegade firefighter who doesn't play by the rules. Oh, no, she doesn't. Hannah is something called a smoke jumper, which sounds like one of those made up movie professions like Keanu Reeves' surfer cop in Point Break. And the way that Jolie's character is introduced, it's lifted straight from the Tony Scott Top Gun Maverick renegade playbook. I was half expecting her to grab her crotch and spit. But you see, Hannah has demons. And we know this because everyone else in the movie is constantly reminding us that she has demons. But there's a disconnect between how this character is set up and the entire rest of the movie. They're like two completely different movies. And it is doubly disappointing when you consider that this was written and directed by Taylor Sheridan, who also wrote Sicario and the brilliant Wind River and the immense Hell or High Water. But
all fantastic films. Let me just jump in for a second because I haven't seen this.
Jump away.
Well, thank you. What has Angelina Jolie's character to do with the missing boy in the
account? The other thing is that
don't have to tell me.
But. Okay, no, I will. It takes so long to get going, but the gist of it is that the forensic accountant and the son they know that their lives are in danger, so that they travel from Florida to the wilds of Montana, where Angelina Jolie is a firefighter, right?
Okay. But
it wastes so much time on pointless stuff that we could have pieced together ourselves. And this journey from Florida to Montana by car, I felt like I was making the trip myself in real time.
It's a long trip.
It's a long trip. But then it kind of turns into this, for want of a better term, it's a sort of a semi-disaster action movie.
Okay.
But it is just, it's very, very weak sauce, I have to say.
Okay. And so, like, you know the way action movies, like you mentioned Top Gun and Toby Scott, they can be wildly entertaining, you know, if you park certain things at the door. This isn't one of those, though.
It's not. And the really bizarre thing that struck me as it was going on was, you know, that actor cliche, this is the role I was born to play.
Yeah.
Angelina Jolie's character is such a non-entity in this that I could literally see any other actor replacing her.
Okay.
And it would not make a blind bit of difference. I have no idea what it was that appeals to Angelina Jolie about Those Who Wish Me Dead, but it's a bizarre movie. Aidan Gillen.
Yeah.
He's doing an American accent. Usually his American accent in movies starts out in New Orleans and then at the beginning of the movie and then goes via Boston to Texas by the end. But he's not bad. And himself and Nicholas Holt play two hitmen who are actually quite good. But the movie is not.
Right, okay. But that's a shame about Angelina Jolie because, you know, she is so certain characters she's played, you can't imagine anyone else playing it. So this seems like the complete opposite of that.
It is absolutely the complete opposite. And it's been a while since she's done something like this. So it's just, I can't work out what the appeal was.
Do you not think Aidan Gillen's American accent in The Wire is bang on?
I have never seen The Wire.
Okay,
I'll have to take your word for it.
I've
seen him do an American accent elsewhere and they are not bang on.
Okay. Well, I'm impressed with his accent in The Wire. You're clearly not impressed with Those Who Wish Me Dead. What stars would you give it?
I'm going to give it two. This, if you're looking for something really, really average, then this is perfect.
It's like if I was on Tinder, well, I'd put up about myself, you know. So that's two for Those Who Wish Me Dead. We're giving 3.5 to Nobody, but the highlight of the week is obviously The Father, which we're giving 4 stars. And all of those movies will be, are now in the cinema at the time of talking to you. Mark, you were the real highlight, of course. Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Up next, Claire Hurling legend and a lot more besides, Tony Griffin on his favourite movie.
Screen Time on News Talk.
Now you're listening to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. It's that stage of the week where we talk to someone well known about their favourite movie. Tony Griffin is a former Claire Hurler and All-Star whose memoir in 2009, Screaming at the Sky, was one of the first Irish sports books to ever talk openly about mental health difficulties in sport in Ireland. Of the many notable things he's done in his life, you have to marvel at his cycling 7,000 kilometres across Canada for charity. And earlier this year, publishing another book, The Teenager's Book of Life, that people are raving about, and it appears to be going gangbusters. On top of all of that, he's one of life's true gentlemen, and I'm delighted to say he joins me now to chat about his favourite movie. Tony, how are you?
I'm great, John. I wish it was all those things you said, but it's very kind of you.
Come. So listen, your favourite movie, tell me and tell our listeners.
Yeah, my favourite movie is The Royal Tenenbaums, and it's just every time I watch it, I see something new in it. I just think it's beautiful and funny, and it's so many things. And I believe it's high on your list as well.
I would, if I was probably asked to do this slot, not that anyone's ever asked me, why would they? It would probably be The Royal Tenenbaums as well. But enough about me, they hear too much about me. Could you tell our listeners just briefly what it's about exactly? Because lots of people wouldn't have seen it.
Yeah, it's about, I suppose, a dysfunctional family, and it's about the plot is Gene Hackman is the dad of the family, and he has 3 kids. One's adopted, 2 are his own. They're all brilliant. One's a brilliant tennis player, one's like this whiz at finance and money, and the other one is an amazing playwright. And then he's a bit too fond of sowing his wild oats. So Angelica Houston, his wife, kicks him out when the kids are children. And then he reappears 22 years later back into their life, wanting to reunite with them, pretending to have 6 weeks to live. And what ensues is they're all living back in under the one roof for the first time in 20 odd years. And it's just the chaos of that. And really, it's about forgiveness, and it's about redemption, and it's just, it's tender and it's also hilarious. So it's a bit of everything.
Yeah, absolutely. Tender and hilarious and forgiveness and all that good stuff. You said to me you had a favorite line in it, and I quoted one, and it was a different line. So what's your favorite line or your favorite scene in it?
It's a little bit dark, my favorite scene. The scene where, and I forget his name, which one of the sons he is. He's a tennis whiz. Who basically, I'm going to give it all away now. Are we allowed to do this? Are we allowed to actually discuss?
You're amongst friends.
Well, for those that haven't seen it, we are going to ruin it. But the tennis player, he has a breakdown, I think Wimbledon or one of the major championships, and he just kind of disappears. And he comes back in to it when the father is dying. He's been traveling around the world on the ship just to kind of escape from the world. And he comes back and moves in home. And the secret to the whole thing is he's madly in love with his adopted sister. And but he comes back into the house. And at one stage, he just decides that he's going to end it all. And it's an unbelievable. Do you know what? It stuck with me. All these years later, I watched it again the other night. I haven't seen it in a few years, but the music, Elliot Smith's tune playing in the background, "Needle in the Hay," which is a great song. And you see him shaving off his long hair. You see him taking off his sunglasses for the first time in the movie. He shaves his beard really meticulously, so you know there's something about to happen. And then he just says to himself in the mirror, "Tomorrow I'm going to kill myself." And then it sounds awfully morbid, but he cuts his own wrists then. But the scene is so powerful. I've never forgotten it. And it's that kind of I think there's many turning points in the movie, but that's one of them where the whole family rally around him and are reconnected around him. And there's kind of flavors of Little Miss Sunshine in it. It's that, like, people who are disillusioned at life refining the joy of life at a deep level.
And that sounds very dark, and that particular bit is, but it is an amazing piece of cinema at the same time with the music and the way it builds up that. But at the same time, this is very much a movie of redemption and forgiveness. It's important to stress that. My favorite line, and we're trying to make this about you, Tony, but what a lot of people love in that is just, again, it's part of a spoiler, but towards the end, when the Ben Stiller character says to Gene Hackman, "We've had a hard year." And he just puts his arm around him and says, "I know you have, Chazzy. I know you have."
Oh, man.
Gets me every time.
That's a great line. It's outside the house. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Look, I think maybe favorite line is different to favorite scene.
Yes, true.
The reason I love that scene is it's just so powerful, important, and the music. But there's so many scenes. Like, there's a scene where Gene Hackman is saying, telling his two grandsons, which Chazzy hasn't let the grandsons meet the father because he's so angry how he let them down and disappointed him and walked out. And he's the two grandsons are kind of knocking around with their granddad, dad having a day out. And they're, again, it's more scenes than lines, but like they're jumping in the back of buses, they're diving off a chair into the swimming pool, they're water bombing a car, and they're just having this wild abandoned fun. And you know, that he's an interesting character Gene Hackman plays, because in some ways he's so self-centered, and yet he kind of saves them all through coming back into their lives. They're all stuck and he jolts them out of it.
Yeah. Well, that's very well described. And we better move on before we go down to Wes Anderson, Royal Tenenbaum's rabbit hole here, quoting lines at each other. But I know you rewatched it as well, so I do appreciate you doing that. And let me ask you then, slightly outside of the movies. Now, I mentioned your book, Screaming at the Sky. And, you know, nowadays there are lots of memoirs about sports stars struggling with mental health issues and all that. And that's a good thing. I'm not bemoaning it or anything. But, you know, 10, 11, 12 years ago, that was a bit of a chance you were taking, to be so candid. Did it feel that way at the time?
You know, I was fortunate, John, that I found a brilliant compatriot to write it with me. TJ Flynn was his name. And we both egged each other on. And it was based on 4 years of my diary. So he was there in front of me. We couldn't hide from some of the writing. And we wanted to bring that writing into the book. And at the time, I didn't know what I was doing. But when it was published, a lot of people contacted me that know me and said, "Are you sure this is okay? Like, could we somehow buy all those books back from all the bookshops and just burn them? Because, like, people are going to read about you and, you know, about where you, what you maybe come through." And I said, "Well, that's the intention, because I know so many other fellas that maybe play elite sports or just people who they kind of silently pull themselves through a difficult patch and then say nothing about it. But I think we're all better off when we realize we're not alone in the world." And so the book, still, people still contact me about it, which 10 years on is bizarre.
Yeah. And that brings us, I suppose, to your latest book and also what you did in life, because in a way that candidness, I suppose, changed your life, because you've become, maybe this is the wrong phrase, but a mental health advocate of sorts because of your honesty in that book.
I think I'm a people advocate. I'm a humanity. Like, I'm a, let's just cut the BS. Like, we're all on this fast moving planet moving through space. Like, there's a lot of reasons to be afraid. And yet courage is such a beautiful characteristic that I suppose I started working with teenagers 10 years ago because in some ways I just fell into it. And it's kind of like the Royal Tenenbaums. It's about discovery and about curiosity. And it's about, you know, finding a life and figuring out a life that is meaningful to you. And so I'm more so about people and interested in people than I suppose I am just necessarily mental health, because that's such a narrow part of who people are.
Sure, sure. Well, that's a good point. So then the Teenager's Book of Life, as I said, it's been going gangbusters, and you were telling me off air all the places it's going to be stocked shortly as well. So this, for the people who haven't read it, unfortunately, I'm one of them, because my kids are all still below the watermark of teenage. So I haven't got to that yet. Now, that's no all excuse, right. But just give us the snapshot of why you wrote it and what's in it.
Yeah, I'd spent these 10 years, as I said, listening to teenagers and like really listening to them, not only in Ireland, but in Canada and Australia. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I learned is it's all very much the same things that young people struggle with. And yet our education system isn't at a stage that can perhaps help them discover who they are in that period of their life. And look, every decade in a human's life is difficult. It's just the teenage years have even more challenges, I think, in some ways. So I had this affinity for teenagers and I wanted to kind of, you know, call them over into the corner and say, look, the adults haven't a clue what they're doing, really. They're making it up as well. So, but here are some things you might benefit from knowing, which are all the things they talk about in workshops that they tell each other. And I just put it all in a book. And our son Jesse was a few weeks old and I used to be driving him to try and get him to sleep. He'd bad colic up around the Wicklow Mountains. And just the phrases and the chapters kept writing themselves. And I'd race home and he was down, write it. And 9 weeks later, the book was there. And I have a good friend who's a great illustrator and she came on board. And we just said, can we write a travel guide for a teenager that no matter what background they're from, they can relate to? And it's a bit of a Trojan horse because if a parent picks it up, they'll say, so this is how I can relate to my teenager.
Mm. Wow.
And we're hearing a lot back that it's actually connecting. Like one kid, their grandparent died. They hadn't talked about it. They wanted to, but they didn't want to upset the parent. The last chapter in the book is on death. And my two sons are in the book throughout, Romy and Bear. They have a conversation about adults and what adults forget about life mm-hmm. as they get older. So parents are using it, teachers are using it, and most of all, teenagers are flicking and reading it, which is a beautiful thing. So it's out there, and people all over the world are buying it, which I'm kind of saying to myself, how did that happen? How is a mother in California or a dad in Norway? Where are they hearing about this book?
Yeah, well, on shows like Screen Time and News Talk, obviously, you know. Yeah, tell me this, to even spread the net further, people can get that on Amazon or on your website or...
Yeah, so there's a website, theteenagersbookoflife.com, and it's in bookstores all around the country. And from next week on, it'll be in Dunn stores. So people will be able to get it when they're getting their messages.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, his favorite movie is The Royal Tenenbaums. Tony Griffin, to ape the movie, is having a good year. Thanks a million.
Ah, thanks, John.
Jesse has those boys cooped up like a pair of jackrabbits, Ethel.
He has his reasons.
Well, I know that, but you can't raise boys to be scared of life. You gotta brew some recklessness into them.
I think that's terrible advice.
No, you don't.
A short clip there of Gene Hackman and Angelica Houston from the wonderful Royal Tenenbaums, as chosen by Tony Griffin as his favourite movie. And there's no argument for me for that as someone's favourite movie, because it's probably mine. And it's the first time anyone's chosen it in the 2+ years I've been doing this show. So make of that what you will. Oh, and I should also mention that Tony's Griffin, The Teenager's Guide to Life, is available wherever you get good books. That is it for this week. My thanks to Anne-Marie Kane, who helped on in the show this week, as she does every week. Just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. right here on Newstalk Radio. I'm open all week long on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me, screentime@newstalk.com. Have a great, safe week, and talk to you all next week.